This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's an interview on the flaws in teaching history, like a thorough examination of interracial conflict.
Texas has all but rewritten U.S. history, in particular around slavery, describing slavery as involuntary workers.
GLT's Judy Valente talks with U of I scholar and Illinois State University Black History Month speaker Adrian Dixon. While Illinois entered the Union as a non-slavery state, it had embraced slavery from the very beginning. John Norton talks with the author of Creating the Land of Lincoln, The Histories and Constitutions of Illinois. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner answers questions about changes in solid waste policy and the budget deficit. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's February 27th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington aldermen voted to change the solid waste fee structure and the frequency of some pickups. They also received a presentation on the budget and approved a one-year moratorium on gaming machines. GLT's Ryan Denham is in the studio with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner.
Bloomington and Normal mayors join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Ryan. Great to be here, as usual.
Alderman chose an option that raises fees on two of the garbage cart sizes and reduces the frequency of bulk waste pickup. Is the discussion of solid waste after years of this finally going to be finished for a little while?
I certainly hope so. It certainly is. We now have, in a sense, a balanced enterprise fund and a means for it to increase in the future. And let me say, you know, this was an enterprise fund as of 2011. It has never been anywhere near breaking even. We had millions of dollars in deficits, and we did close some of that gap about 4 years ago. But now we're really there. I really was stunned for a few minutes right after last night's city council meeting, but we did it and we're moving forward. And I think overall this will be a reasonable compromise. Is it what any one individual wanted? No. But that's part of what the legislative process is all about and policymaking generally.
So there's a $4 increase for 95 and 65-gallon carts, no increase for the 35-gallon carts.
And if I could point out on that,
sure.
One of the good things about that is that helps to help encourage people to further recycle. If you don't want to pay anything, you can downsize your cart for free. So get rid of that 95-gallon or that 65-gallon cart and go down to a 35-gallon cart, frankly, which is what I have. And I, like this morning, when I put out my trash, it was barely full. And my recycle was, I had to stuff it down, you know. So essentially, if you don't want to pay anything more, you have that option. Just recycle more.
What about the flip side of that? Is there any concern that the cheaper option will end up contaminating the recycling stream with people opting to put, you know, garbage in the recycling cart because they've run out of room in their actual garbage cart?
There's always that kind of risk. You know, in talking to mayors in other cities, they're depending on what that increase is. You know, if it's $4, it's probably less likely that we'll have problems like that than if it were $15 or $20 a month. So, you know, in one of the proposals would have raised the small cart fee from $16 to $26. Now, again, $10 a month might not seem like a lot, but for some people, that might be the incentive for them to throw whatever, paint cans and other stuff that should not be in recycling, in a recycling bin.
So some aldermen were hung up on the annual 3% fee increase. And costs go up, but this 3% increase was proposed in the context of a reserve, building up that reserve.
Absolutely.
Is that reserve, how's that going to be used? Is it going to be addressing capital improvements like new trucks, that kind of thing?
Well, that is yet to be determined by the council. Right now, the council has passed that policy. And this is based, let's be clear, on a 25-year rolling average. And whether or not some years it's been 2.9 or 3.1, we've had about a 3% increase with everything included, and that's not that's salaries, although salaries have rarely gone up 3%. Salaries usually are considerably lower than that, but your overall cost is higher because healthcare goes up at much more than 3%. And then obviously you've got to buy new trucks and you've got to buy new equipment and you've got to fix the old equipment. And so for over about a quarter century, it's been an average of about 3%. So at this point, future councils will inherit a very different situation, a much better situation than what we inherited. And that is, if they do nothing about trash, it will still continue to pay for itself.
And there's no sunset built into this. So how long do you think it'll be before the council takes a look at that 3% increase?
My guess is they're going to ask some serious questions within a year. I think that was part of the debate last night, even by many who voted in favor. Again, this passed 6-3. There will be three council members who did not like the 3% increase. And so I think they will be asking questions. But even the six council members who voted for, this was not a blank check. The council never gives anybody a blank check. So I would say that this is going to be part of the annual review process, which it should be part of a budget. When you go through a budget, that doesn't mean that you don't ask tough questions about what's happened in the past. So certainly the council next year could say, no, that 3% was enough. Right. I doubt that they will do that because we really should have capital reserves. And that will help future councils balance other parts of the budget because the general fund and, in other words, taxpayers overall won't have to in their revenues, whether it be property taxes and mostly sales taxes, continue to subsidize trash.
Well, let's pivot and talk about bulk pickup. So the change that was made last night was instead of every other week, bulk pickup will be, not for free, but for the cost of admission two times a year, fall and the spring. And if you call Public Works, pay $25, you can get an extra bucket pickup whenever you'd like. So does that mean the city will no longer be losing money on bulk pickup, or is that going to be fully
We're still losing money on bulk pickup. It's just that the overall, and I believe the figure last night was it cost us about $125 a scoop. And that's actually quite a bit of material. And right now we're only charging $25, and in the future that's about all we'd charge. It's just that we actually have a surplus in just picking up trash. So that surplus in just picking up trash will subsidize the other pieces of the pie, if you will.
Well, are you concerned at all about the accumulation of bulky waste potentially, stacking up outside of properties as a result of this change going from every other week to just twice a year?
Yeah, that is a possible concern. The thing is that we do now have much more aggressive code enforcement. And it's obviously, it's whether or not it's something like that. It's not perfect, as we have seen with the recent fire and hundreds of violations of people who are landlords with dilapidated properties. Now we have an administrative court, which we can haul them in within usually 72 hours, or like the situation at Gettysburg apartment, we can also be filing complaints in circuit court.
The action last night on last night's agenda and in the last several meetings have been structured a little bit differently. So aldermen chose option two of three proposals that way they were presented with, these kind of sample motions that were kind of listed on the agenda. This level of organization on agendas is new. It's kind of like a menu almost if you're at a restaurant. Is this something that that interim city manager Steve Rasmussen has brought to the council? And what do you think of it so far?
Under the budget, Steve and I talked about the predicaments that we've gone through in the past when we've had tough budget decisions and thought that presenting some tangible options, as Steve began to do back in December, not quite like sample motions, but ideas. Okay, this is what it would take to balance the budget. If you don't like this, then this. Make this trade-off. Here's some examples of ways that you can do that. And I think Steve has provided fantastic leadership on getting the council to be more productive in making the decisions for budgetary trade-offs generally, and obviously with solid waste in particular.
That's Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. I'm Ryan Denham, and this is Sound Ideas. Let's continue this discussion on the budget. You heard from interim city manager Steve Rasmussen on the budget last night. Fee increases and service cutbacks will help erase a third of the deficit that we've been talking about here today. How confident are you that the council will walk out of meetings next month with a budget in hand and that aldermen will actually have forward momentum on this thing?
No, I think I'm very confident. Now, if you'd have asked me this last week, I might have said I'm fairly confident, but I'm definitely very confident now, because one of the toughest decisions was the decision on solid waste. And once we've got that $1.1 million piece out of it, it was the largest single piece. And the difficulty is that we're always looking for economies of scale, and we're always looking for trying ways to save money. But we had well over 100 employees more back in 2009 with a smaller population, and we were delivering the same services. So we've cut, and by that I mean full-time equivalent employees. So, and that's usually the best measure. So we're down well over 100 employees, and it's harder to find big cuts anymore. And that's one of the things that the budget task force that I put together in the summer of 2015 found. There were lots of suggestions that they had. I thought that that was actually a great success. And it was a success in not because we found a golden goose, but because a lot of the things that people were talking about either weren't going to save us money or weren't going to save us anywhere near what you had thought. For example, privatizing the golf courses. You know, we can argue whether or not it was a good idea to build two extra golf courses. That's immaterial right now. We've got three of them. And with those golf courses, even if we were to privatize them, we're still on the hook for capital expenditures. And so it does us really no good. So essentially, we do still have, in the future, we'll have budgetary challenges. But when we vote on this, and I believe actually we will be voting on this in April, probably the first meeting in April, rather than in March. We do the March meeting, we're still looking to have more of a deep dive budget workshop on a Saturday, and that doodle poll is not producing what we, you know, a magical date for us yet.
What did the council do last night in regards to video gaming, and what direction this is going to
go? They did vote for a moratorium on video gaming, and I have mixed emotions about that. Not because I am pro video gaming, quite the contrary. I think it's really unfortunate that we have such a large, we're one of the top cities in Illinois outside of Chicago in terms of gambling. So I think there are some issues. But I would not have put on a moratorium. It passed 9-0 for 1 year, and that's for a variety of reasons. One is the current, mostly bar owners who are making incredible profits.
So why did they pass a moratorium? What was the logic there?
I believe the main impetus for this may very well have been the Circle K proposal in Ward 5. Amelia Burgess, councilwoman from Ward 4, suggested maybe 3 to 6 months, and let's take a look at some of this. I would have proposed that. Now, one of the other reasons why is this is not necessarily good public policy, but this is Illinois law. And so if you give someone a particular type of liquor license, then they can have video gaming, especially if they're, you know, like Fridays could have that. But Fridays is, that's not their business model to have video gaming. So you have to have a liquor license in order to have video gaming. And so there are some possible downtown investors who have plugged into their model of profit some increment of money from video poker. It also means, again, that the people who currently have the video poker machines are probably really having a big smile this morning because they now have a monopoly for at least a year.
Do you think ultimately the city can extract more money, more revenue out of those machines, either through ultimately a licensing fee?
Every other metro city in Illinois has a fee on top of the percentage that is quite, that the state taxes. And so normal is $200. That's on the low side. Many are $500, $1,000 per machine. And the thing that you can be sure of is nobody will take their machines out because the profit on that is, the profit margin is really unlike anything I'd ever seen.
Mayor Renner, thanks for your time again on GLT's Sound Ideas.
Thanks so much, Ryan. Take care.
I'm Ryan Denham.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal answer questions on Sound Ideas following regular Monday evening at council meetings. You'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Koos during Sound Ideas next Tuesday. Thanks for choosing 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable and timely financial management with a contemporary independent perspective. Zimmerman and Armstrong have been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is GLT.
Coming up during Sound Ideas, GLT's John Norton talks with the author of a book that explores the history of slavery in the home state of the Great Emancipator. The interview is ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The teaching of America's multicultural history has come a long way from the largely white, Eurocentric version students were taught for decades. Most of the progress has taken place at the university level. That's according to Adrian Dixon, this year's Black History Month speaker at Illinois State University. Dixon, who teaches at the University of Illinois, tells GLT's Judy Valente that the teaching of multicultural history still leaves a lot to be desired, especially on the elementary and high school levels.
The elementary through high school curriculum has kind of failed to really capture those moments where people have organized across race and class and gender, sexual identity, to again kind of push us as a nation to live up to our ideals.
What's missing in your view?
I think what's missing is a real robust kind of analysis or an examination for young kids and an engagement on interracial cross-class struggle. Labor movements, kids learn very little to nothing about labor movement struggles in formal curriculum. And, you know, Texas has all but rewritten U.S. history as it pertains to almost every group, literally, and in particular around slavery, describing slavery as essentially they were, you know, involuntary workers. That slavery was a worker program and slaves never got paid.
That's actually a term that's used, involuntary worker.
Yeah, it's involuntary worker. I believe they describe them as immigrants. And it was contested when Texas went through their revision of U.S. history for the state and what that curriculum would look like. It was certainly contested by, I have colleagues at the University of Texas at Austin, but that's what the state legislature and the Department of Ed had a hand in kind of crafting that, and that's what the official curriculum is. We just haven't kind of done enough to talk about, again, how different groups across a number of demographics have agitated for full citizenship, religious identity, you know, Catholics, agitated quite rigorously for curricula that fairly represented Catholicism, and in part why we have such a vast Catholic school system in the U.S. was a response to the distortion of Catholicism in public education early on in our founding. The same with people who identify as Jewish, who follow the Jewish faith, that schools didn't allow for, they had to agitate to have religious holy days off. So, I mean, we've had this kind of contested history that has played out in schools. Our students tend not to learn about that. And so my bigger critique is that when students and young people want to organize, they don't necessarily know the history of that, of how groups have organized and have pushed against oppression and distortion of history and marginalization.
You mentioned Texas. What examples do you have of Illinois? What have you seen in Illinois? Because you visit a lot of schools in Illinois.
I mentioned Texas in part because Texas and California and Florida are very influential in terms of the social studies curriculum, and also actually just in textbooks in general. Illinois, fortunately, has it gone the extreme of Texas. Texas is an anomaly, and it always has been.
One of the other critiques that you make in some of your writings is that teachers are not well trained to teach about the cultural history, the multicultural history of our nation. What are the drawbacks, deficiencies that you see, and how do we need to deal with them?
It's just a challenge of preparation in general. Elementary teachers essentially have to be specialists in every subject matter area. So if you imagine as an undergraduate in a university setting to be an expert and have expert knowledge in math, science, social studies, language arts is a heavy lift, right? Some middle schools teachers specialize, but it requires a more in-depth study of a particular content areas. And that's a, I think that's a limit of just the preparation model. But coupled with that, the way that we invest in teachers, we leave it up to school districts then to figure out what professional development and ongoing support teachers need. And often content area development is not as robust as it could be for a host of reasons. Most of the challenges are structural. It shows up in what they're able to do in the classroom.
You point up an interesting example where you go into a classroom where a teacher is talking about John Brown, the abolitionist, yes, and says that John Brown was biracial.
Yes.
And that was clearly not correct. You point that out, that is not correct, but that was what was being taught to these students.
It was a school in North Carolina.
Okay. So what other glaring examples have you run into?
Well, some of it is around what I think is an over-reliance and a kind of fixation with testing really stifles the amount of time that teachers have to focus on content. And because I think teachers do a Herculean job of trying to avoid teaching to the test. And I would say that it's really challenging for them to avoid that, in part because the test drives so much, right? It drives the perception of quality of instruction, the quality of the school, and the very intellectual capacity of students. Teachers who are able to kind of balance a fidelity to their content area and not be swayed by only covering what's on the test is a huge testament, again, to their kind of fortitude, because it's difficult not to do that. And so I have witnessed, though, teachers who have tried to balance with test prep. So in particular in urban schools who are under an incredible amount of pressure to perform well on standardized tests, there's an inordinate amount of time spent on test prep that takes away from content.
I want to move now to another topic that you write about, mm-hmm. And that is the Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. organization group.
Yep.
You call it a moment and not a movement. And you seem to be semi-critical of Black Lives
yes.
Matter. What are your issues there? Why is it not a movement?
As a university professor, I'm happy to see young folks attempting to speak back to what they see as oppression and inequality, racism, and all the other isms. It makes me happy to see some political activity. The movement building piece is a much longer process, and I don't know that we're there yet.
Yes, you quote Angela Davis as saying, "A movement takes years."
Yes, decades. So I was fortunate enough to, and she just actually wrote a book about this, but to hear her talk about, you know, she's over 70 now and is still working on building the movement. And a liberation movement for people who are disenfranchised in the U.S. And so it's a longer arc. And I think we're quick to call any kind of organizing a movement, in part because of our ignorance of how people have organized early on in our history. And in part, again, because we don't necessarily talk about the struggles of labor and the struggles of people of color and the struggles of the LGBTQ community and gender movements, ethnic minority movements. We just don't, that history is kind of glossed over if it's ever really addressed. And so whenever we see people agitating and protesting and speaking back and demanding change, we immediately call it a movement. And I don't know that we really have that kind of when I think about the civil rights movement, it was very organized, and there was a real network that people were kind of plugged into that had coordinated efforts, and there was a communication system. I think that that's emerging. I just don't think it's there yet, and so that's why I'm hesitant. But I'm hesitant to say that we're fully in a movement.
Do you see Black Lives Matter as being a contributor right now to the social discourse on race a major contributor?
I think they are important. I think that these issues have never kind of fallen off the table. I'm encouraged when I see young people organizing because there's really no incentive for them to do that. And I say that as an educator because I know that the struggles that we have in curriculum in particular around getting these issues as a part of the official curriculum. So the fact that that young folk are motivated to organize is always encouraging. And I think it has created a public discourse. I think what's interesting is the way the mainstream media, and I'm just a little skeptical sometimes when things that are supposed to be radical become the darlings of our mainstream discourse, because generally radical agitation isn't a popular idea. But I think that certainly social media has helped to broaden the platform for Black Lives Matter.
U of I Professor Adrian Dixon speaking with GLT's Judy Valente via Skype. Dixon's presentation, Race, Protest, and the Challenge of Multicultural Education, is tomorrow at 7 p.m. in the Prairie Room of the Bone Student Center. Her talk is free and open to the public. You're listening to GLT. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. While the state of Illinois entered the Union as a non-slave state in 1818, for all practical purposes, Illinois embraced slavery at its founding. Frank Cicero Jr. is the author of Creating the Land of Lincoln, the History and Constitutions of Illinois, 1778 to 1870. Cicero tells GLT's John Norton slavery was a legacy of the French inhabitants of the 1600s and Anglos and Americans of the 1700s. He says Illinois' first governor, first lieutenant governor, and president of the state's first constitutional convention were all slaveholders.
A lot of them came over from Kentucky. Illinois, as many of us in the North don't fully realize, is bordered by Kentucky and in part by Tennessee in the southern part. A lot of slaveholders had come across from Kentucky, Tennessee, but also from other places in the East.
It is interesting how Illinois settled, because it did settle from the south and up into the middle of the state, and then later it settled in the north from New England and Europe. Here in the middle of Illinois, where we're at, we're like smack dab in the middle of Illinois in McLean County. You go about 30 miles south of here at most, and you can tell the south begins. Where you go north of that, it feels more like Wisconsin, and it's like Bloomington Normal is, and McLean County is almost the dividing line between the north and south, even in Illinois, not just geographically, but from how people settled the state.
That's correct. The settlement came up and from the south until the 1820s, 1830s, when the construction of the Illinois-Michigan Canal in the north began. There began to be a lot of immigration. A lot of Irish immigrants were brought in. A lot of people began coming in from across the lakes. When the Erie Canal was finished in New York in 1825, thereafter settlement increased in the north and changed the character of the state.
It wasn't out of the question when Illinois became a state 200 years ago that it would enter the Union as a non-slave state. It was fairly close.
There were a lot of people who thought it should come in as a slave state, that the Constitution should permit outright chattel slavery. And in fact, two years, after the Constitution was adopted, an effort was undertaken to revise the Constitution in order explicitly to allow chattel slavery rather than the contrived devices that the 1818 convention created.
Well, I'm going to get to that in just a bit. Let's go back to 1818. Slavery was not permitted by the Constitution in Illinois, but as you write in Creating the Land of Lincoln, essentially it was slavery in the form of indentured servitude. Can you talk about how it came to be that slavery was outlawed, but indentured servitude was okay?
Well, the Illinois Constitution in 1818, like some others, had a paragraph flat out prohibiting slavery. And then it had several paragraphs of exceptions. for so-called indentured voluntary servants. Now, indentured service was an old thing. It goes way back. English settlement used to come in with people who were contracted to serve for several years as a servant and so on. But this was different because they were blacks. Many of them were blacks brought in from other states. And the provision said if they don't agree to a voluntary agreement, a quote-unquote voluntary agreement, they could be, within 60 days, they could be shipped back to the slave states. So they had no real choices, no real voluntariness. Many of the contracts were for 20, 30, 50 years, 99 years in some cases, and it was slavery for all practical purposes.
When what is now Illinois was part of the Indiana Territory and then the Illinois Territory, when that split off, wasn't, and it was part of the Northwest Territory at one point, right?
Correct.
Wasn't part of that territory agreement that slavery would not be allowed?
The Northwest Ordinance and the Northwest Territory was not supposed to allow slavery. It was interpreted by the slaveholder officials from Ohio that meant slavery being adopted hereafter, after it became a territory or after it became a state. And that was the exception that basically was interpreted in Illinois. Illinois had been settled beginning 1690s and later by French who had slaves brought up from the Caribbean. And one of the exceptions of the prohibition, one of the permissions, was for people who had slaves who were born as the old French slaves, to continue as slaves. That was a condition. Also, Illinois was, before 1800, it was a county of Virginia for a short time. And one of the things that Virginia insisted on was that there be slavery permitted.
We're talking with Frank Cicero, Jr. He's the author of the new book, Creating the Land of Lincoln. It's the history and constitutions of Illinois from 1778 through 1878. And this is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. I want to move on and talk about the Illinois northern border and how that came to be. That's a fascinating political story in its own right, and it had major political ramifications on the state in its history. Can you briefly just outline how that northern border came to be?
Yeah, I think it can be outlined briefly. Under the Northwest Ordinance, which governed the old Northwest Territory, was intended to allow five states, three on a lower tier, and that turned out to be, of course, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, and then upper tier states. The provision, however, was that the northern boundary of those southern states, that is the southern tier, would have their east-west boundary, the north, through the southernmost point of Lake Michigan. And that would mean no shoreline. When the Illinois Act, when the act came before the Congress, to enable Illinois to form a constitution and become a state, one man, the non-voting delegate from the territory of Illinois, Nathaniel Pope, who was a Kentuckian by origin, got an amendment to the Enabling Act that said that the boundary would be extended 60 miles north of the southern tip of the lake. That included then Chicago, which would not have been in the state originally. It included what would be the mouth of the Illinois-Michigan Canal, which opened commerce down through northern Illinois to the Illinois River, to the Mississippi, and on to the Gulf. And that was achieved in 1818 in April by one man who garnered the votes in the Congress to make that change, a huge change. Without that change, Illinois would have basically been a southern state, much smaller, much less commercial development, et cetera.
Did he have the vision to know that an area right around what is now Chicago would develop because of that, the access to the Chicago River and the Lake Michigan shorefront?
Yeah, there were two things going on. Historically, the route from the Illinois River, which became split off as you went north into the Des Plaines River and the Kaskaskia River in Indiana, those two rivers would be a route that would take you to Lake Michigan and on down to the Illinois River. There was a small area of 6 miles or so that was a portage between the Chicago River and Illinois River. That area became included within the state and enabled the development of the Illinois-Michigan Canal, et cetera. But it was a historically well-known trail But the canal and that development opened up commerce to the south and opened up commerce across the lakes to the east, and eventually resulted in settlement of northern Illinois.
Well, let's talk about that. So not only now do you have access to Lake Michigan and the Chicago River and ultimately then the Illinois River and the Mississippi, but it also, moving the border that far north, also included a lot of land now in northern Illinois. Did Pope have a vision that would have a difference for the state of Illinois as well?
Yes, he did. And that's one of the things that is remarkable, because the two reasons he expressed for making this boundary extension were, one, Illinois, if without it, will be a southern state settled from the south. And then he said confederacies like the United States were prone to disunion. And then in the event disunion happened, under those circumstances, Illinois would be a southern state and go with the south. On the other hand, he said, opening this area up will open up commerce to the north and the east, result in commercial development and so on, which will assure that Illinois is a northern state and will become part of any northern breakup, helping to prevent a southern breakup. Very, very remarkable foresight. Slaveholder from Kentucky in 1818.
Well, that was my next question. Was Nathaniel Hope a slaveholder, and was he a pro-slavery person?
Well, he was a slave owner for much of his life. He was the first federal judge in Illinois and was a federal judge for many years, from 1819 until he died in 1850. And for most of that time, yes, he still was a slaveholder.
Creating the Land of Lincoln is the new book by Frank Cicero Jr. He's speaking with us via Skype on GLT's Sound Ideas. Well, let's talk about that northern area of Illinois then, because it had political, huge political implications on the state. Did he understand that people from New England and Europe would be moving into that northern part of the state and change the dynamics of the politics versus, you know, the folks who settled the southern Illinois?
I think he did. He expressed that. First, some facts. The boundary amendment added 14, what are now 14 counties and 8,500 square miles. So it was not a small amendment. It was about, that territory is about, I think, 18 or 19% of what the state is now. Secondly, the Army engineers and others were talking about creating this canal to link the Illinois River to Lake Michigan and the Erie Canal. Everyone saw that coming. Mm-hmm. Great prospect. 1825 was the Erie Canal opening, and he saw that coming, as well as did others, and that was what he was trying to enable.
And it did change the political dynamics of the state itself, where the southern part of the state was very pro-slavery, or at least pro-indentured servant, but the northern part of the state was more abolitionist.
You know, John, that's interesting, because when I first, I mean, I grew up in Illinois. I grew up in Cook County, but right down in the southwest part near the Illinois-Michigan Canal. And when I started to look at doing something on Illinois history, I picked up a book on the canal, and there was one sentence that said, the amending act, the enabling act, amended to add this territory to Illinois. And as soon as I found out how much it was, my immediate reaction was, holy cow, that's the area where all of these northern votes came from to enable the Republican Party. That's the area that in later years, of course, was dominated by Democrats in the north. But at that time, it was an area that enabled the Republican Party to carry elections instead of the Democratic slaveholders from the southern part of the state.
Well, it's interesting what you write about in light of today's political climate, that the first Illinois Constitution allowed for both citizens and non-citizens to vote. And of course, that meant just white males. What was the reasoning behind allowing non-citizens to vote back in when Illinois became a state?
Well, that was not only an issue in 1818. That was a big issue in the next convention in 1847, and a big issue in the two later conventions in the 19th century. The rationale was very simple. A lot of these people were landowners, and they did not have to be citizens, but they had to be white to vote, and they had to be either citizens or landowners. So that much of the land was settled by squatters and others who were landowners by possession or had become landowners. And that was an issue not only in 1880, as I said, it was an issue in other constitutions. And then it became political because the immigrants that were filling up the northern area with the import of 100,000 Irishmen to work on the Illinois-Michigan Canal and others, these people were not citizens. And the move by Republicans at that time was to allow the non-citizens to vote. So it was a huge battle for three constitutions.
Frank Cicero Jr. also says the 1869 convention included protracted debate over whether to allow African Americans to vote, even though the Civil War was over and the 15th Amendment allowing blacks the franchise was in place. GLT's John Norton talked with Cicero via Skype. He's the author of a new book, Creating the Land of Lincoln, The History and Constitutions of Illinois, 1778 to 1870. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Okay, so we're in a world where it seems that a month of breaking news now happens every day.
Used a vulgar slur in reference to
injured in a school shooting in Western
Kentucky. Prompting a shutdown on
Larry Nassar will spend at least 40 years in prison.
In a week, an Amtrak train has crashed.
An emergency alert that there was.
Morning Edition is with you every day to slow down the news, make sense of it all, ask what really matters. Listen every day.
Here, Morning Edition, Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. For nearly a half century, Bloomington's Miller Park had segregated beaches. African Americans had to swim in a debris-filled area of the lagoon. One young girl even became tangled in the debris and drowned. The community will soon note that history of segregation and racism that lasted into the 1950s. WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talks with historian Mark Wyman about efforts to put up a state historical marker outlining discrimination in Bloomington. Wyman says the idea for the marker grew out of research he conducted with Jack Muirhead, which found that for several decades after the Civil War, African Americans actually did okay in the Twin Cities. Wyman says they could vote, eat in restaurants, and stay in the major hotel, the Ashley House.
And then, toward the end of the century, things began to change. Jesse Fell died in 1887, and the Leader newspaper that was a big supporter of integration folded in the 90s. And there's records of the Colored Voters League meeting in 1895 and starting to complain. They met with members of the three African-American churches then, and they came up with a resolution that we should not patronize stores that refused to hire African-American salespersons. And there's more complaints. And then in 1908, the Park Board ordered racial segregation for swimming in Miller Park Lake, which had only started a couple of years earlier. And there was enormous opposition. And the city council in Bloomington voted 9-4 that there would be no discrimination in Miller Park. And then the Springfield riot occurred here in Lincoln's hometown, several deaths and a lot of people injured and black homes and stores up in smoke. And that cut off the debate. And then after World War I, as African-American soldiers were coming back into the community, and the NAACP was formed in Bloomington in 1918, so a big opposition developed. And then the Chicago race riot occurred. And so debate again was just cut off here. So the 20s then saw a lot of segregation, not backed by laws, but just restaurants, hotels, movie theaters made blacks sit in the very back rows. And so that was the 20s, and the Ku Klux Klan marched in Bloomington and towns all around here. So that was our segregation then that became pretty thorough, and it didn't start to yield really really much until World War II, when black soldiers would come home on leave and refuse to move when they sat in the movie theaters. And then right after the war, 1947, right here at ISU, there was a little cafe near campus just south of where the Alamo is that was segregated, would not serve African Americans. And mainly veterans began to march, black and white, and they forced it to change. So from then we get into the 1950s and part of the national movement against segregation.
Where did the idea for this marker in Miller Park begin?
So what Jack and I discovered in our research and talking to people, people weren't aware of that. Did we ever have segregation here? Nope, too far north. No, never heard of it. And that was over and over. So I realized there is a secret. This community has a secret that they don't know, that racial segregation was pretty thorough here from the early 1900s, at least in the 1950s, and didn't really end until the 1960s. That led us to say we've got to have a historical marker, Miller Park Lake, marking the 1908 official beginning of segregation there.
And it continued. Until when? When was it lit?
Well, the lake was closed for swimming in 1953 because it was so unsanitary. And then they made a lot of changes in the water supply, and we got a new mayor in Bloomington, 1957. And he made it his goal to open it to swimming, even though health department was opposed. So it reopened in 1957 for integration, no mention of segregation. In fact, I saw the secret really develop then, because in all the editorials about reopening and the speeches by the mayor, no mention that it used to be segregated up till it closed in 1953.
Some people might be listening to this and say, why a marker? Typically, you think of monuments and markers as sort of celebratory or marking heroes or positive activities that occur, and some of the maybe darker part of our history is included in history museum, which has an educational purpose. Markers, monuments, typically more celebratory.
Well, part of this, I think, is just to end the secrecy. That's a narrower focus. I also want to note that I realize now this is a national trend. In New Orleans, which had the biggest slave auction center in the country, they had a bunch of statues honoring Southern Confederate military leaders in the Civil War. And the mayor in New Orleans led an attack on these. Instead, he said, let's have a marker that here was the largest slave auction center in the country, that we need to remember these things to help us guide our way into the future to see what bad things happened. So they are not forgotten, and people think of the past as a wonderful era. Well, we are part of the past. As Faulkner said, the past isn't even over. In fact, it's not even passed.
Have you had much discussion with city leaders about this marker, and are they behind the effort? Because it's not necessarily a thing they're going to put on the map for the Convention and Visitors Bureau.
I would hope they would, but I would say I've found no opposition. I met with Steve Rasmussen, who now is interim city manager, and he's very positive on it. Karen Schmidt, who's ward covers Miller Park, was really very enthused. And other people that I mentioned it to, a couple of other aldermen who didn't know anything about it, but their reaction was very positive. So I've encountered no opposition.
How much is the marker going to cost, and how are you doing on your fundraising efforts?
Yeah, I knew it would cost money, but it never worried me. And my expectations have been borne out. Right away is when I would mention it in talking to groups around town about our segregation past, people would come up and say, I want to donate. And the NAACP came through, not in our town, came through. And several individuals then who read about it in the Historical Society newsletter contacted us and said, yes, I want to give. So I think the total is about $4,000, and that has been reached pretty easily, I would say.
Anything anything else as we wrap up our discussion about this historic marker in Miller Park that you want to make sure people listening understand as they hear about this effort?
In one way, it's easy to talk about some bad stuff that was done in long ago. And Germany is having the same problem with the Holocaust. And they have gone through a bunch of different stages there. And how do you teach it in the schools? And some people say, we don't want to make people just ashamed. And so they've got things like brass things on the ground in front of a home where a Jew was taken away. They've got a giant memorial in Berlin, the things that look like caskets, a whole field of them. So other places go through this. How do you deal with something bad in the past? The marker is just one way.
Historian Mark Wyman talking about a historic marker slated for Miller Park, noting the history of segregation in the Twin Cities. Wyman talked with Colleen Reynolds. The full transcript of what will be included on the marker can be found at WGLT.org. That's also where you can find the individual stories and interviews you hear on Sound Ideas, and you can subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast at our website. I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.